This is episode 17 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Welcome to another show.
So as this is being aired, we will be at LinuxCon.
Oh, you know, it's funny. I usually like to not tie us to any particular
week because,
you know, we might
have to change schedules around. But I think we should target this. And
all right.
For a very specific reason. Because what we're going to do today is, well, if we really had our druthers together, we would schedule it so that you could hear the talk we're giving at LinuxCon on the podcast as we're giving it at LinuxCon. But we way don't have our stuff together for that possibility. But what we're going to do is we'll use the talk we gave at the Linux Collaboration Summit, and people can hear that talk that we gave back in April, which I think is really interesting too.
Which we didn't record, but we still have the, of course, we have the material for.
Right.
So we'll have our...
And we practiced because we gave it.
We practiced, but I guess maybe I'm hedging because I'm sort of like, we haven't practiced in some time. So
that's true. But you know, it's like riding a bike, isn't it? We'll just get back on and we'll be ready to go.
All right.
I think so. Well, I think people will enjoy this talk. You talked in the previous podcast about how it's always great when you can get a chance to talk about stuff.
Yeah, I think we've referred to this situation on our podcast, but this way we can let our listeners have the full picture of what happened.
And one thing, this may be a podcast where you do want to listen in front of the computer. So those of you who listen while commuting and stuff, I think it'll work for you. But if you are in front of a computer, we're going to put the slides up on the website. And you'll notice at every time it's using a system called S5, which is a JavaScript-y thing to do slides in web format. And I'll put a time index at the end of every line and that's when you hit the space bar. I always do this.
You're looking at me like I'm going to do this. I just
think it's so much more convenient for people.
It is. It's so much work on your part. I would never promise it. I'm happy for you to promise it.
Well, it's easy enough to do if you listen to it once. And I always listen to the podcast once before we put it out. I'll do that. And I have that I've done that for the other talk. So when you see the time index, you'll know it's time to turn the page. When Tinkerbell flaps her wings.
Tinkerbell flaps her wings?
Did you never have those as a kid? The little record? Maybe I'm just old. But when I was little, I had a little record player.
Uh-huh.
And you'd get these 33 records.
Yes.
And they had little books with them. And it would read the book to you, and it would be some fantasy book of some sort, and the Disney ones obviously had Tinkerbell, and it would say, you know, it is time to turn the page when you hear Tinkerbell flap her wings like this.
Oh, see, I know what you're talking about because I remember having, you know, records or cassettes or whatever, and having, you know, whatever it says, to turn the page when, but it was always, you know, maybe I was thinking of like language labs and things. When you get older, it's boring, when you hear the beep.
Yeah,
beep.
But for little kids, they would have the ones that would have some sound from some animal in the story or something like that, or Tinkerbell in the case of the
sound
Peter.
Be?
I don't know what our sound is, but you'll know it is time when you see the time index. If you watch the time index on the podcast, hit the space bar where the time index reaches that number.
We'll just try to say so when we get to the next.
I'm not going to say so. People can do the time index thing.
We'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right, so let's see if we can remember how this goes. The title
Well, it's
is...
not like a song. This is a talk. This is about...
La 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 la. It's Lessons Learned from Auth5k, Copyright Stewardship in the Linux Codebase.
Well, it's a great opportunity, really, for us because this whole situation happened so publicly. It was like many things in the free software community. It wasn't the most friendly of conversations at times, but it was an opportunity to address some issues between the OpenBSD and the Linux community, to solve an issue about getting a very important piece of code into the mainstream of Linux, and hopefully making a better process for that sort of thing going forward.
Yeah, and it was a great experience for us because it was a situation where there was some real misunderstanding, and through a little bit of legwork, we were able to not only have everybody understand each other, but also make the situation a little bit better off at the end.
So people will probably want to know why we want to relive a licensing flame war. I think one reason is that sometimes you are basically condemned to repeat the past if you don't learn from it. And I think that we've had licensing arguments so often in the free software community and never really resolved them and learned from them.
We get the same situations again and again. And, you know, as lawyers, we wind up having to address the issue in front of us. So we apply what we know to the facts before us. But a lot of that time, that means we can't share that more generally. So this was a good opportunity to sort of talk more generally about, you know, about what happens in questions that come up again and again and again in different formats.
Yeah, and it's an opportunity, really, to improve the legal infrastructure for free software, because there are some things we can learn from this scenario that will help the legal infrastructure of the Linux community, but I think even more generally, the legal infrastructure of any project where there's both GPL and BSD stuff going on. It's an opportunity, really, to improve that.
And because we can. I'm always talking about how frustrating it is that we can't always talk about what we work on because of client confidentiality, but because this basically started as a flame war, almost everything we can actually talk about.
It was public, basically.
Which is why it's as funny as a story as we get.
I think it's funny because some of the arguments were overblown and way beyond facts, and therefore made it a little bit funny.
There's a lot of color in the story.
and because we're licensing geeks, the intricacies of a licensing argument are actually kind of funny to us, and I think to anybody who's stuck with this podcast over whatever many episodes we're at, the 20-somethings we're in.
Yeah.
I think that using decimal.
We're in episode 1-6?
This should be 1-7, right?
1-7, 1-7.
Right, yeah. So we're in the 20-somethings if you must use decimal. So this all starts, like a lot of free software stories often do, with somebody posting a patch to a mailing list. The mailing list where the original patch that started the whole situation got posted to was actually a sub-list of LKLM. So what happens a lot in the Linux community is that Linux is so big that there has to be sub-lists to discuss various subsystems. So there's a Linux wireless mailing list, which is where John Linville, who's the wireless subsystem maintainer, maintains a conversation about patches and other stuff coming in to the Linux tree that he maintains. Of course, because they all use Git, Linville maintains a tree, which is the Linux wireless subsystem tree, and then other people pull from that, and he posts pull requests to LKLM when he wants things to get pulled in. So
it's just a patch.
Yeah, indeed. What the patch... Well, you jumped in, so I thought you
I were, did, I'm sorry.
So what the patch did was it took a driver that had been reverse engineered and written from scratch by a developer in the OpenBSD community to support the Atheros 5000 series chipset in wireless cards. And what had been the case in the past was this chipset was supported with a binary HAL, or hardware abstraction layer. It was this binary blob. If you've heard about binary kernel blobs, this is one of them, that gets loaded onto the card when it's initialized. And it's really software. It's not hardware, really. It's a software firmware that gets pushed onto the card, and it creates an interface layer that Linux can use. So this was how the driver worked historically, and it was a proprietary driver. What the OpenBSD guys did is they reverse engineered the hardware and wrote a firmware and driver, full stop, everything in it that worked on that chipset. And what one of the developers had done was port that over to Linux so that that technology could be used inside Linux as well as the OpenBSD
and
kernel.
Basically with the rationale of, well, you know, Linux is GPL, therefore when I port this to, we'll get to this in more detail, but when I port this to Linux, therefore my work has to be under GPL. So the patch added the GPL license.
Right, because the developer actually, there was some level of confusion there, and the confusion actually started right there that it had to be GPL, which we're going to talk about later.
Right.
But he felt, well, okay, so this is a GPL
and it was
work
just
now.
A patch proposal. Nobody accepted it at that point.
Right, it was just a post to a mailing list. I mean,
yeah,
really, it was
it
just
point.
A post.
Yeah.
Then incorporated it even to the tree. It was just a post to a mailing list. But there, as is happens from time to time, particularly with the OpenBSD community, somebody finds out about something and it becomes a big level of rancor. And this, I guess, was 3 years ago, almost to the day.
Oh wow!
Because
it was a few weekends ago. Yeah.
So.
Wait, wasn't it Labor Day? I can't remember exactly which.
Well, I was confused. It's funny. I can't remember the day because I was confused Labor Day and Memorial Day in the U.S. and they're I can't remember.
That. I think it was. I actually can't remember because there were a few different Slashdot posts, and I do remember sort of waking up on a holiday weekend, and I think that it may have actually been two different ones, but I don't remember. It'd be worth finding out.
Yeah, well, it's. I don't know if the exact timeline. We don't need to construct it.
No, it's true.
So their complaint was not necessarily an invalid complaint. I think it was expressed a little more aggressively than it needed to be, but they felt that the patch didn't have a copyright notice in it, and therefore it was not carrying along the copyright notice of the developers. Well, because it was a patch, it didn't have every last copyright notice because it was patching a file that had a copyright notice in it.
And their standard sort of what people do in submitting patches is not necessarily sort of the traditional the way that people submit patches isn't necessarily 100% over taking into consideration the copyright rules. So a lot of patch proposals are technical violations because they don't have all of the license notifications, they don't have the entire license, but usually it's a technical violation and people understand that, and you know there's sort of understood licensing terms and more than that, there's usually express licensing terms, so there's something you can rely on.
And people realize, everybody who's a copyright holder in the works understands that you can't display every copyright notice every time you post a patch to every mailing list. And so everybody's basically accepted that, well, technically the copyright law just was written before anybody understood how patches worked. So we can't really be perfect, but this is the way our community operates and it's all acceptable to everyone.
And, you know, we'll be very clear and we'll say what patches are under what licenses, et cetera.
But there was this argument that somehow, for various reasons, this work licensed under what's called the ISC license, which is a very permissive, you can also sort of think of it as a one-clause BSD. That particular license somehow didn't allow incorporation of GPL works. Well, our view has always been, and the view historically in the community, is that the ISC license is what's called a GPL-compatible license, therefore it was permitted. So there was this disagreement that the OpenBSD guys didn't really want it pulled in. And I felt what was really happening here was the BSD community was saying, we want this thing to stay ISC licensed. So they didn't want the license to change. It was kind of we dubbed the term emotional copyleft. It was a sense
now,
that...
There are rules about ISC licensing. ISC licensing does require that the license notices remain.
Correct.
And that patch did not have the ISC licensing in it. So,
yeah, and that was certainly a legitimate beef. But I think what the OpenBSD guys were looking for was an opportunity for the derivative works to continue to be licensed under ISC, so the changes could get back. I mean, I think that when they were very demanding the ISC license stay, I think that's really was their ultimate goal.
And we did all this work for reverse engineering, and if you're going to improve it and make changes, you should give them back to us.
So we end up getting involved because we represent. As a legal matter, we're the lawyers of the Linux Wireless team, specifically John Linville, in his capacity as the wireless network stack maintainer, had asked us for legal advice with regard generally to the Linux Wireless stack.
We had done other work
related to various issues regarding wireless stuff. And he came to us and said, well, you know, we now have this problem. We're being accused of copyright infringement and all these other things. And of course, as lawyers for any developer who's operating in a not-for-profit way, which in his role as Linux Wireless maintainer, John was, we were happy to represent him and the whole Linux Wireless team in this matter.
Yeah, and I see that we refer to in this slide that we assisted clear up other ambiguities. And that's basically, and I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about that, but it wasn't too long before that we had issued an opinion with respect to reviewing the code against Atheros's code. Yeah. So the same set of code had questions drawn to its potential infringement in a whole different direction.
And we have a statement on our website, we'll link to that, that folks can see, where we basically cleared up some of those concerns by negotiating with Atheros, effectively.
Well, negotiating with Atheros, but that was negotiating with Atheros to provide a situation for us to confidentially review the code so that we could compare the code base and as an independent entity come to an opinion about whether the code was infringing or not.
Right, and ultimately it was as far as a reverse engineering situation.
Work that we wound up doing for the Linux Wireless team, but it's work that benefited everyone using that code base.
Yeah, I think that's true, although I don't know know if folks really realized it because there was a lot going on at the time, yep. And so forth. But it's related to this situation because the fact that we had done that analysis and felt that the code was something that really could be used in Linux safely was what inspired people to start pushing it into Linux right. and posting patches, which right, is right. how this new situation started. And we were contacted by both John and Luis Rodriguez, who is involved with the Linux Wireless team as well, contacted us to try to help solve this situation. So as it went on, this flame war just right. got out of hand.
It was immediately slashdotted. Of course.
Yeah, that was. I hate when that happens. It does happen far too often in our community that it gets to be a news story before the conversation.
I haven't been at SFLC that long yet, and already I was being attacked on Slashdot. And what was interesting was that I was accused of legal malpractice. Actually, I stuttered to even say it. I was accused of legal malpractice, but hilariously, so were you. So we were sort of all named as being bad lawyers.
Well, technically, I could, because I'm working for SFLC, if I did something really bad, I could theoretically commit.
Well, you could be contributing to our legal malpractice, correct. Right? I mean,
like for example, if I started telling people I was a lawyer when I'm not a lawyer, which I say all the time.
You are not a lawyer. Yeah, you're quite good at that.
So yes, we did not have any legal malpractice that we committed, although it was accused in this flame war.
Yeah,
people say things
very 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 jarring. It's not something people don't throw that around lightly. It's a big deal. So
yeah, but
you know,
in flame wars in the free software world, they throw everything around lightly, unfortunately.
I suppose, but yeah. it definitely I still laugh about it now sometimes when people ask me about my people who are not in our space who ask me about my work, and I say, well, I've been accused of legal malpractice.
Yeah. publicly. Yeah. So the claim was that there was somehow by posting patch there was some sort of serious copyright infringement going on, and the copyright infringement is a matter of degree, I think, for anybody to look at. You know, there is things.
And we talk about technical violations, and we talk about other infringements, and it's as with anything, there are sort of there are different degrees of any kind of wrongdoing.
And initially, the complaint was, well, the copyright notice didn't appear on the post, but there was also this argument that the work done to port R5K to ATH5K, i.e., take the code base from OpenBSD and port it over to Linux, was not copyrightable changes. Because what happened was the developer who had done a substantial amount of the work to port it over, it was a team of developers, and they had added their copyright notices to the work because they had done work to adapt mm-hmm. and improve the driver so that it would work with Linux. And what we did from SFLC's point of view is try to negotiate a zone of agreement, as is often said, between the two parties and try to find an amicable outcome that both sides would be happy with and try to treat the OpenBSD community with the respect that they absolutely deserve mm-hmm. because they'd done a tremendous amount of work and really impressive work. I don't get down at that level of code very often, so I don't know a lot about device drivers and so forth, but we're just reading CVS logs of the OpenBSD, which I did as part of this process to learn how the code base worked and how the porting had happened and so forth and when the fork happened. I was just really impressed by the work that Rake, who was the developer,
and
did.
There
was really interesting
so much
work.
Misunderstanding on the legal points and so much bad feeling that a lot of that was getting lost.
Yeah, and I think actually the ATH5K developers really were they were incredibly happy and excited to have this code base that they could use. And what they really just wanted was legal assurance that, okay, we can bring this code to Linux. And we've been working on this issue, as we mentioned, from the other side of it was the reverse engineering acceptable and can it be used safely? So we'd already been looking at that question from that direction. And now there was a new legal question. And they just wanted to get this legal situation
clear. Right, their needs were very simple. Yeah. And actually, the OpenBSD guys,
the acrimony died down.
Right, right. What they wanted was actually quite simple too. Is that they wanted the patches back. To the extent that there were improvements made to their code base, they wanted it in a license that they could use and reincorporate into their into OpenBSD.
Right. And in the OpenBSD community, the only license they can accept is one that's it's a very simple some sort of permissive non copyleft license, and that was really important to them to be able to get that back. And they wanted, because the key requirement of the ISC license and other BSD like licenses is the attribution
and notice,
they wanted that attribution and credit, because that's the thing that they get is mm-hmm. credit. And that's really what their license does for them is make sure that you give credit to the developer who developed the software and their copyright notices appear. And they wanted to make sure that that happened and that people who downloaded source copies of Linux would know, hey, this, you know, there's right. some developers from OpenBSD who have made Linux better and they wanted that credit. And totally reasonable mm-hmm. demand. Mm-hmm. I think that was lost in the beginning in the acrimony of the arguments. But once we began to calm everybody down, I think we came to something that was a total reasonable ask for their point of view.
Yeah, and it actually took some time to figure out that was the quote so-called zone of agreement. Mm. It took some time to figure out what each side actually wanted, and in part because there was so much misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And
I was just gonna go.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say. So what we did was we basically decided to, you know, in our slide we say bury them in good documents. We decided that we should publish as much clarifying material as we possibly could. You know, and we wanted to do so in a issue by issue manner. So we wanted to show that that the Linux developers had actually acted responsibly. That there wasn't ill will, and that B, they didn't act inappropriately by submitting a patch proposal.
Yeah, and we wanted these publications to have some value beyond the situation. We wanted to educate people about the issues that were coming up and in the hopes that folks, when these kinds of situations came up, would be more likely to have cooler heads and read through what are the actual facts and how to resolve.
As we say, we can't talk about a lot of the stuff that we do. So when we come to a situation that we can talk about and it can be instructive, we want to provide that information available is readily available and useful as possible for other people. So what we did was we wrote three separate papers so that each of the issues that we dealt with could be useful more generally later when that same situation came up again. The first one was on copyright eligibility, and that document
specifically copyright eligibility in the US and the EU.
In the US and the EU. And that I was about to say, this actually reads like a sort of like a law review article. It's a little bit more academic. It talks about what technically is copyrightable and in the US and the EU. So
and that's a question people ask a lot because it's hard to make the judgment whether something is copyrightable or not.
It usually is part of the problem,
right,
it's creative expression, but almost anything is considered to be creative expression. It's tough, and there's, you know, you'll ask people, well, what is the minimum number of lines that we need to consider for being copyrightable?
And there isn't
a minimum. You can find creative expression in very brief and succinct.
I should take the opportunity to say that people have had this thing, and it's sort of showed up in the community around the mid-1990s, that 5 lines of code, anything less than 5 lines is not copyrightable, more than 5 lines mm-hmm. of code is copyrightable. That is, frankly, just kind of hogwash. I mean,
the shorter the submission is, the less likely it is to have creative expression, but you can have creative expression in those 5 lines. So it's better to treat it like, you may as well treat it as if it has the creative expression so that you can freely license it and share it appropriately.
Pretty much the only thing I tend to tell people that is not copyrightable is a true typo fix, meaning a spelling fix. Those types of things are clearly not copyrightable.
I mean, and there are times when we can go back and take a look and say, oh, well, actually now looking at the whole work and how each line is used, mm-hmm. we can evaluate it for whether or not we think there's copyright infringement. But, you know, or whether there is copyrightability in that expression. Yeah. But it is a tricky and detailed analysis, and the law isn't really that clear on it.
Yeah, so developers, when they're accepting something, they have to assume they get a patch, it's copyrightable by the author submitting it and previous authors that it derives from. I mean, you have to just assume that's the case, because if you don't, you're likely to get it wrong sometime if you are too liberal on the non-copyrightable side. And we talk about that relatively academic way in that first paper. And the second paper was focused on helping developers understand how to maintain a permissively licensed work in a larger GPL codebase. And it's possible to do that.
Yeah. So it's actually a how-to.
Yeah, I think people assume that you can do that, because once a lot of people talk about the GPL as the universal recipient, that it can take everything
the blood.
Yeah, that's the analogy people make, which I think is not really fair, because if you make a conscious choice to say, I've got a large code base, the code base as a whole is GPL, but there are certain subsets of the code base where I feel I want these files or these subsystems to be usable by another project under a more permissive license. You can do that. There's some care you have to take. You can't be as fast and loose with taking patches in and throwing them into the code base really quickly. But if you take care and pay attention to what's going on, and where the code gets touched and what copyright holders are touching it, then you can totally do that. You can
now,
totally do this.
Just to clarify, and I know we've said this a few times on the podcast, but if you release code under a BSD license, that code will always be, or at a permissive license, that code is permissively licensed. And then if I want to take it and use it in something else, you've given me permission to do that under the permissive licensing. And if I want to make changes to that permissive licensing, it's my changes that I can put my own copyright on with a license that, you know, you gave me permission with the permissive licensing, so I can then, you know, I have permission to make my changes under the GPL. So that's how it works, is that just then the changes are GPL, then the work as a whole effectively becomes treated like a GPL work, because you can't take it with the changes unless you take those under GPL. So in effect, the most restrictive license is the GPL license, and therefore, you know, you use, I'm sorry, you're smiling at me.
No, I wanted to add that I think that's actually the main point the OpenBSD developers were trying to make in a lot of ways. And I think the flame war hid the fact that that was a very reasonable point that they were making, because there was a lot of flaming going on.
And this way we were able to share that, but with instructions on how to actually technically go about maintaining it.
And then the paper that I mostly wrote was I was talking before about how I went through all the code bases and carefully looked at who made what changes when. And it was a really tough job. It's really hard, even with modern version control systems, to go through and do that. I had a lot of trouble, for example, with Git rebase, where people had rebased things, and I had done my analysis based on SHA-1 sums built up along a code base. And when you rebase, all the SHA-1s change. And so I've had some trouble with that. I've actually exchanged some email since we first gave this talk with the Git maintainer about solving it, and it's sort of not exactly solvable as a problem, and it's unfortunate, but I think that when we do need to do this analysis, you just have to be super careful and actually look at actual changes. And I did lots of diffs of patches, which is, by the way, really confusing when you diff a patch against the patch, because you get the minuses and pluses twice, because you're diffing the patch which has minuses and pluses in it, because it itself is a diff, and then you're diffing a patch against another patch, and you have to have like a certain mindset to be reading diffs of patches, which I'm sure people run into sometimes when they want to see if the change is the same as someone else's.
So where does this leave us?
Well, I think we have to look at what improvements can be made to the Linux community.
Right.
One of the biggest confusions that's bothered me, it goes back to a debate I had with Ted Cho in, I think, 1998, about making sure that they had, because they didn't accept or didn't require copyright assignment for contributions to Linux, but it was never made clear completely that when you contributed to Linux, you were licensing it under GPL, and what specific, you know, GPL v2 versus GPL v2 or later, and so forth. And they added in the 2000s, I guess it was early 2000s, the signed off by tag, which was ostensibly a blanket signed off for every reason you can imagine something you would sign off on something, both technical and legal. And I think what's happened is many developers are, as they should be, are focused primarily on the technical side of what they're doing. They forget or never knew or didn't read enough to realize that they're not, when they say signed off by, they're not just signing off on technical matters.
Right, they're making legal representations.
Right, they're saying that they, as a patch submitter, even if they're not the copyright holder, are sure that they can license this in a way consistent with the Linux licensing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something people were surprised. Some Linux developers I've talked to, I now have a habit of, ever since I learned this, every time I talk to a Linux developer, asking them what they think signed off by means. And a lot of them don't know this, or are only vaguely
clear. Or just don't think about it and are often not the ones.
Yeah. And it's really an attestation that it's a heavy attestation. I don't know if that's a good way of putting it, but you're basically saying, if you're a subsystem maintainer, for example, you're saying when you say signed off by, that you've done extensive checking that the patches you took into the thing you're signing off.
Well, you're not saying you did extensive checking, but you say that you know.
You're representing. You know.
You say that you know, and in order to be able to say that you know, you or I would probably do extensive checking.
Yeah, and credit to John, who takes this very seriously. John Linville, our client, he takes this very seriously, and that's why he came to us for help.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of subsystem maintainers, it just doesn't cross their mind. They're hackers, and they want to be focused on the technical decisions, but these legal things get in the way sometimes, and you have to pay attention to them. And I think I talk all the time on our podcast about this stuff, about dual license. And there's this idea in the Linux community that you dual license things, ISC or GPL, disjunctive dual licensing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really confusing to talk about that because it's overkill.
Well, this is also what we were talking about before, which is that people take the work under the most restrictive license that's contained in it. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of making sure that you maintain the portions of the work or the portions of the code base that are under the permissive license and can be continued to be developed in that way so that they're not taken as a whole with other restrictive licenses only and can't be separated out.
And we had this part in here about the possibility of collaboration because the talk was originally given at the Linux Collaboration Summit. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a nod to that audience. But I think it's worth thinking about for everybody that you do have to take a certain amount of care with licensing when you try to collaborate across copyleft and non-copyleft projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we didn't say before, and we've talked about this in the past, and you and I have had our arguments about it, in fact, on the podcast here. But if you choose to license your work under a permissive license, you are allowing your work to be used in a whole host of ways. And that means you're allowing your work to be incorporated into proprietary software, and you're explicitly permitting that and permitting your work to be used along with GPL code. So basically, when you grant that, and now it's a particular idea, and it's a good thing to grant. I mean, there's no value judgment here, but I think a lot of people don't really think about it when they agree to license their code under a permissive license, what that actually means. Yeah. And when we say permissive, it's really permissive.
Right. And this is where I talk about this issue of emotional copyleft, because I think that there has been historically so much acrimony, is the best word I keep using, because it really fits, between the BSD communities and the GPL communities. And I think that in some ways, I feel like the BSD community sometimes treats GPL worse than the proprietary guys in some ways, because from their point of view, you're taking away freedom in their view.
Right. Well, there are different ideas of what freedom means. Yeah, right. We've talked about
the freedom of baby mulching machines, as Theo de Rot is famous for saying that he doesn't care if his code gets used in a baby mulching machine because he wants to give people absolute
freedom.
Well, hang
on a second. All free software licenses that are truly free don't have any restrictions as for use.
That's true enough. So you can use GPL code.
You can use it for whatever you want. Restrict that usage in any way means that it's not
free. It's not free software. True enough. Yeah. No,
I just want to make sure that's very clear.
I know it's very clear, but I think what Theo's point in that is to say that he wants to think about the most horrible thing you could possibly do with code and wants to permit it.
I don't want to make any judgments, but it's because it's truly free. It can be used for anything at all,
right,
in any way.
And I think that what happens between the two communities is that because they have this difference of opinion about freedom, which has nothing to do with what you use the code for, but whether you require someone downstream to do certain actions,
right,
that the BSD guys would say is onerous, I think that disagreement sometimes bleeds into the ability to collaborate and to the admission by the BSD folks that, yeah, you can take that BSD code and put it in to GPL code and
right, combine. But of course, we're all a lot better off if we work together.
Yeah, and I think we should encourage people to work together more in this way. And I think it's a matter of respect. We've debated this on the podcast before, but I think it's a matter of respect to a liberally licensed developer or somebody who chooses a permissive license to be willing to give your changes back under that same license. I always try to do that. I mean, I'm a hardcore copyleft person when I start my own projects and when I pick projects that I will contribute to. But there are times when I find a project I really want to contribute to that's Apache licensed or other permissive licensed, and I always give my changes back.
Yeah, well, it's respect for a community that developed a code base that you find useful and that that you're improving.
Yeah, and I think we also should look to what the BSD community does well. I've seen a lot of interesting reverse engineering work mm-hmm. come out of the BSD community that we don't do as much in the Linux community, basically, generally the copyleft community. And the BSD guys are really good at this, and we should respect that work and make use of it as much as we can.
Oh, we're already at the end.
Yes, it was not a long talk. It was designed for 40 minutes, remember, when
that's,
we gave it?
That's right, that's so, right.
Because we don't have time for questions. Of course, you guys have to wait and email your questions in after you hear it, so you can't interactively ask us anything. We're not going to do a call-in show. I'm just sorry, we won't.
But then we can't have
You look like you want to do a call-in show.
Well, I was going to say that we can't have somebody say long-time listener, first-time caller.
Aaron already said that, remember?
Oh, he did.
Or, yeah, well, he said long-time listener, first-time guest or something whatever like that. Like that. Yeah.
Anyway, all these three papers are available on our website, and so you can take a look at them. We tried to make them as generally useful as possible, which is why we took all of the paper that talks particularly about this situation only down to one paper. So it basically only one of them talks about F5K. You can email us at help@softwarefreedom.org if you have any questions.
Right. Yeah. This is the reason this is in the slide here. You know, if you're facing legal issues, we don't say this enough on the podcast, really. If you're a free software developer and you're facing a legal question you don't know how to solve,
and you need legal representation,
and you need legal help, that's help@softwarefreedom.org. You know, podcast software freedom is really to talk to me and Karen about specifically stuff we should say on the podcast or stuff we said that you didn't like
or stuff
we said that you liked. but the address help@softwarefreedom.org, that's where you write to when you say, help, I have a legal issue and I need help. And we encourage people to get in touch with us. We represent a few kernel developers specifically. We mentioned John Lindell. Mm-hmm. And we note that, you know, the Linux Foundation folks have said that they can't really provide legal representation, and we're happy to represent Linux developers.
Yeah, the Linux Foundation, again, and we talked about this actually on our podcast.
Yeah.
Karen talked about the Linux Foundation, but they're, you know, they don't provide legal representation to the kernel because they don't represent the kernel. They only represent the companies that are the trade association that
correct.
Make
the and people get confused because they do employ a lot of kernel developers to do work, but they're not giving legal advice to those kernel developers with regard to their work. And when LF does, Linux Foundation does legal stuff, it's primarily to advise those companies. We actually gave a version of this talk to some of those companies to help them understand these issues as well. And so when you're a developer and you need legal help, I mean, that's what SFLC really is here for, to give you that legal help.
And then here's a slide that we don't really talk about either on our podcast too much, which is that we are a nonprofit charity, a 501c3, and we take donations, and those are very helpful for us.
Yep. So I think we should wrap this segment and turn back to our normal podcast mode instead of our speaker mode.
All right. Now you'll notice that I know we got out of presentation mode, but we kind of slipped in and out of it actually. But we did go with the CC attribution no derivative works for our presentation
because you wanted it,
which was a negotiation between us. But since we recently had our a podcast about
documentation licensing,
I thought that was kind of an interesting to talk about. Also, because it's consistent with our podcast licensing, right?
Yeah, I mean, so including this in the podcast will work just fine. The licenses are compatible, as we see. I think it's I'm glad to do this material one last time and get it out there for people and have sort of a historical record. We've told the story so often, and it's an old story now, but I'm glad to let our podcast listeners hear it one last time. And I think the issues are still ongoing. I think particularly the signed off by thing is still an ongoing confusion.
And I think making sure that people really understand, you know, what it means to license your work under a permissive license and what it means to try to incorporate that into a GPL work. They're fundamental issues that developers come across every day.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. And I really do want to see the copyleft, non-copyleft divide. And I think enemies of free software, people who want to hurt free software, they try to make that divide bigger. They've been trying to do that since 2000. You know, companies like Microsoft and Oracle that are not particularly friendly to free software, they've tried to divide those two sides. And I see folks who do Apache license stuff, folks who do permissive license stuff. That's part of my community.
Well, and this is what's so great about working at SFLC, because we're license agnostic. So we are not tied to copyleft or permissive licensing. Mm-hmm. We support free and open source software. So and all the licenses that accomplish that in different ways are appropriate for different situations.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, the reason I'm a fan of copyleft is because I believe that having a constitution, if you will, and that says, you know, this is the rights people must have. That's why I like GPL. But the community, other communities get this done in other ways,
yeah.
I think. And we don't necessarily need always need a legal infrastructure, and I've contributed under permissive licenses to lots of projects, and I'm actually doing more of it now. I'm contributing, I'm starting to get involved myself, contributing more to permissive license works than copyleft, just because the projects that I'm interested in contributing to, they existed before me, before I made contributions anyway, not before me human-wise, life-wise, but before I was making contributions, somebody else established the project, and they picked the licensing structure, and that's the truth about licensing, is that the person who starts the project picks it. And right. decides, and it has to, a community builds around that, and changing the license is possible, but it needs community consensus and agreement.
And it's so important to talk about these issues up front, because we've had the situation more than once where the person who chose the original license didn't necessarily appreciate all the facets of those licenses. So, you know, you can avoid these situations by making sure that we have an understanding of how to appropriately maintain these co-bases.
Yep, definitely true.
Well, thank you for joining us. You can write to us with questions at podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
We weren't saying that enough. Now we're saying it too much. we like to hear from the listeners. And we notice we're actually had to, this is a meta point, but we actually had to move recently from hosting on our own website, because we have just a small little bonded T1 in there, 3 megabits, that we couldn't host the media anymore. So fortunately, we've gotten donated services to host the media. And I'm still in negotiations, so I don't want to announce a thank you yet, but probably the next show I'll be announcing a thank you for that. But we have gotten that solved, because we know that folks had trouble downloading. I'm perhaps going on a limb here. Thank you, saying it's solved now, but it has to be solved by now.
Will this get aired before LinuxCon?
During LinuxCon.
I was going to say, if you hear this before LinuxCon, come and say hi.
Yeah, it'll be in the middle of LinuxCon, I think, when people are hearing this. Okay.
See you next time.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
So we have to come up with a new talk now.
What is a podcast but a new talk every 2 weeks anyway?
Excellent point.